KNW 1590 AM Denmark, W250 CV Green Bay,
and always streaming on the Civic ABC Media
News
app.
I'm Mark Remillard. Powerful rains coming down on the Burning Man Festival in northern Nevada, prompting many to leave or shelter in place. Authorities have now closed the gate to get into Burning Man for the remainder of the event. Las Vegas also seeing flooding. Two people hospitalized after a barrage of Russian drone strikes on the Ukrainian port city near Odessa. President Biden pledging federal support for residents of Florida impacted by Hurricane Idalia. Biden surveyed the damage during a tour of the hard-hit city of Live Oak on Saturday. Florida resident Amy Firestein says many people lost their homes.
It's a great community. Everybody helps each other and wants to help each other, and we want to rebuild. We want Cedar Key back.
Thousands of customers remain without power. A looming strike for the nation's auto workers. Some 150,000 members of the United Auto Workers Union prepared to go on strike. The current contract with GM, Ford, and the parent company of Chrysler expires September 14th. Workers calling for better pay and fewer working hours. This is ABC News. The search continues in Pennsylvania for an escaped inmate who was sentenced to life in prison just last month. Chester County authorities say convicted murderer Danilo Cavalcante was recently spotted on a homeowner's security camera not far from the prison that he escaped from. Nearby residents told to stay inside and lock their doors. After a three-year pandemic hiatus, some 43 million federal student loan borrowers are set to see their balances rising again as interest started accruing on Friday. And on top of that, payments set to restart next month.
For 33-year-old Ashley Robinson, that pause in payments has been a lifeline. She struggled for years to pay off her student debt, her loan ballooning to $50,000 because of interest. That balance now about to get bigger. The restart of student loan payments next month is a crucial test for Americans' monthly budgets, already strapped by higher borrowing costs for mortgages, credit cards, or car loans after a string of interest rate hikes by the Fed.
ABC's Elizabeth Schulze, Mark Remillard, ABC News.
The Talk of Green Bay, 1590 AM and 97.9 FM WGBW programming is broadcast from the Bug Tussle Studios.
Bug Tussle, keeping you connected to the world around you.
We're in the Civic Media Truth Booth at the Brown County Fair. We asked, and here's what you are telling us about living in the Green Bay area, attending the fair, and more.
Novalee Phelps. I work at the fair at Sheridan Amusements. I work with the kiddie rides. I set up, tear down, wash them, and run them, make little kids happy. I run the raceway. I set it up, tear it down. I help with other kiddie rides. I love to put a smile on kids' faces.
Thanks for sharing your story. Listen for more on the Talk of Green Bay, WGBW 97.9 FM, 1590 AM, and Oshkosh Air Support, WISS 1100 AM, 98.3 FM, and the Civic Media app. And our website, civicmedia.us, and search for Truth Booth. And watch for the Civic Media Truth Booth coming to your town soon.
For Civic Media News, I'm Terry Bell. At least 32,000 kids in Wisconsin have lost health insurance coverage under Medicaid since May. Mike Moan takes a look at the reasons why.
States are redetermining people's eligibility after pandemic rules officially ended in May. The temporary provision automatically kept recipients enrolled. But now that it's expired, many children are being dropped from the rolls as their families lose coverage. William Park Sutherland of the Wisconsin-based policy group Kids Forward says it's bad timing with a new school year here.
Kids that have stable access to health insurance are more likely to do better in school. They're more likely to be employed as adults. They're less likely to visit the emergency room.
He says even if parents no longer think they're eligible because of a boost in their household income, there's a good chance their kids still qualify, with the income limits being different for children. Joan Elker with the Georgetown University Center for Children and Families says it's worrisome that many of the Medicaid losses aren't because the state determined someone isn't eligible.
We're in this unprecedented historic situation where states that are generally understaffed have to process eligibility checks for everybody on the program, and that includes half the children in the country. So this is a massive undertaking.
National estimates have shown that 3 out of 4 children who lose Medicaid coverage are likely still eligible. Policy experts say there are common reasons why families have a hard time keeping up with their enrollment. That includes renewal letters being sent to an old address after a recent move, or transportation and technology barriers, especially in rural areas. Mike Moen, Wisconsin News Connection.
And this is Civic Media News. I'm Terry Bell.
I'm Kareem Abdul-Jabbar. I learned about atrial fibrillation the hard way. My symptoms would come and go, shortness of breath, fatigue. I kept going. Then I got so lightheaded, I couldn't. My doctor said I have AFib, so I'm about 5 times more likely to have a stroke. Other symptoms, irregular heartbeat, heart racing, chest pain, can come and go, but the risk of stroke stays. If you have symptoms, tell a doctor. Visit notimetowait.com.
Sponsored by Bristol-Myers Squibb and Pfizer.
The Talk of Green Bay, 1590 AM and 97.9 FM WGBW programming is broadcast from the Bug Tussle Studios.
Bug Tussle, keeping you connected to the world around you.
Missed your favorite show? It's easy to find it wherever you listen to podcasts. Apple, Google, or civicmedia.us.
Welcome. Grab your favorite morning beverage and join us for Morning Cannolis with Jim Santel.
You don't know me, but I'm your brother.
Sampling the news desserts of the week, here is your host, Jim Santel.
Good morning and welcome back to Morning Cannolis on this Labor Day weekend, Saturday, September 2nd. Thank you so much for joining me in our discussion, our continuing discussion of a lot of different things happening in the areas of criminal prosecution, civil litigation affecting our elections, and the conduct of a number of individuals back in January 6th, sentenced this past week by a federal district court judge in Washington, D.C., taking some phone calls from you as we concluded the last hour, continuing into the first moments of this hour as well. We appreciate those tremendously at 844-967-2789. Also, you can go online and send a text to my wonderful producer and me. We'll take your comments, your questions through text as well, through Civic Media, your particular radio station identified with Morning Cannolis. So we appreciate very much hearing from all of you. Right before the break, heard from Joe, who was asking a very important question about the significance, the long-term significance of these sentences imposed upon members of the Proud Boys by the Federal District Court Judge Kelly just this past week. Again, Joseph Biggs, 17 years in prison. Zachary Rell, 15 years. Ethan Nordine, 18 years. And Dominic Pozzola, 10 years. The question Joe asked, a great one, is what happens in the federal system? And basically, is there such a thing as getting out early? I know there's a general sense out there based upon television, movies, that sentences don't mean what they normally mean, and that 18 or 10 years or 17 years or 15 years, whatever the imposition of a sentence might be, is not in fact that. Well, it turns out that many, many years ago, when I was an assistant U.S. attorney, the law changed. The Congress changed the law. And in the federal system today, there no longer is a thing called parole. Again, not related to the state system. That's different. In the federal system, no longer any parole. So that today, when a federal district court judge, as we have talked about, imposes a 17-year sentence upon Joseph Biggs or an 18-year sentence upon Ethan Nordine, that means that those people will spend that amount of time in federal prison. Those sentences are real, and they will be released from prison from the custody of the Bureau of Prisons when those terms are concluded. Now, there is such a thing as good time. You can get a few days every single year if you behave yourself when you're in prison. Otherwise, you're a good prisoner and do not engage in any sort of misconduct, any violence. You can get some consideration, but that's not parole, and it does not significantly limit the amount of time that you're in prison. Bureau of Prisons has also some capacities, some discretionary opportunities to engage in some sort of compassionate release along the way based upon healthcare-related issues that may come up. And of course, you can always go back to a federal district court judge and seek some kinds of relief, depending upon what your particular circumstances are. But the upshot is that 17 and 10 and 18 years in federal prison means just that. Appreciate very much the comment from Joe about that. And secondarily, Joe was commenting about this notion that we've got at least one federal district court judge now who, with a bit of reluctance, nonetheless, is beginning to find, as are other judges, that the conduct of people on January 6th, this engaging in seditious conspiracy, is not just that. It's also domestic terrorism. And the judge imposing these sentences finding specifically that their conduct, again, doesn't have to involve blowing up buildings or sending airplanes into buildings or engaging in mass violence involving murders and deaths and those kinds of things that we may normally associate with terrorism activities. It can be and also is just this, a very significant thing that Judge Kelly is telling us now under the interpretation that he is making, but nonetheless increasingly advanced and embraced by other federal district court judges, that this kind of conduct is domestic terrorism. That's what he found when imposing these sentences. For what it is worth, not only are these not the sentences that the U.S. Department of Justice wanted, but the judge actually downward departed, if you will, engaged in what's called a downward departure under the federal sentencing guidelines. Even with those enhancements, these sentences very, very much lower than they otherwise would have been had he imposed sentences within the prescribed sentencing guidelines. But again, the important information there, this particular enhancement related to domestic terrorism applied in these cases to people who are terrorists. We know from testimony of the director of the FBI recently that domestic terrorism has become the number one threat to our nation, identified by the FBI, and the number one focus of its activity, investigative, and then referring these cases to prosecution by the U.S. Department of Justice. Domestic terrorism, the number one threat identified by the FBI to our national security and our safety. Appreciate very much those comments, that good question, Joe. And we'll take more comments. And again, from Mark calling in this morning, your comment or your question. Mark, appreciate your time this morning.
Yeah, I perhaps it's respect to my career as an auditor when I do an audit work. But I see the linkages here that includes scattered here and there, maybe the net just scattered, that there was coordinate. Apparently, there's at least contact between the Trump campaign and the members of the Proud Boys and other groups that engaged in the insurrection on January 6th. And I noticed that both Marjorie Taylor Greene, Lauren Boebert, who have engaged in what I would consider stochastic terrorism with their flashing of firearms and all that, within days of their inauguration to their various offices on January 3rd, were in support of the terrorist activity on January 6th. And both of them voted against, you know, Joe Biden's election to the office of, you know, to the office of president, you know, for the certification, as did Scott Fitzgerald. And let's remember that Scott Fitzgerald was a coordinator in the fake electors thing here in the state of Wisconsin. So there's a connection between the fake electors thing, because that was a nationwide conspiracy. I can say that safely now because that's what the evidence that I've seen so far indicates. And that connects to that before the election in 2020, apparently there was contacts going on, just in case we lose, these are actions we're going to take. And after the election, there was contacts going on, the election they need to take to keep Donald Trump in office.
Right.
You know, got sure. more desperate.
Those kinds of things, Mark, again, they're implicit, if not explicit, in the federal indictment that we've talked about a lot. We'll talk about it again, time permitting, this morning as well. But also certainly in the Georgia indictment, that again is this connection between what you describe appropriately as violence to our democracy, and the connection between the overt violence of January 6th and the impact that it has on our democracy. That tie between the actual violence on that day and people who are managers, who are supervisors, the people who have been indicted in Georgia, the specifically named 19, including our former president, the other people, including our former president and the unindicted co-conspirators in that January 6th indictment in Washington, D.C., all of them involved not only in organizing, supervising, directing all this, but trying to accomplish exactly the same thing that the Proud Boys and others attempted to do on that morning of January 6th. So the connections are unmistakable. Anticipate that as these trials go ahead, and we will be talking a little bit more about the scheduling of some of those in just a few moments or so, anticipate that those connections may well be a part of the in-court presentations. Again, the significance, Mark, of the comment you're making between the conduct on the ground on January 6th, the attempt to stop the county electoral votes, and the involvement of the people who put these schemes in place to rob the American populace of their proper votes and their election of Joe Biden as the president. And so the point could not be more clear. Appreciate very, very much that comment, Mark, and look forward to more of your commentary about all of this in the future as well. Finally, we have on the line Danny. Danny, you've been waiting for a long period of time. Your comment or question this morning, anticipating some good discussion as well. Go ahead, Danny.
Yes, hi. Well, let me tell you like this. I thought last week you were publicizing Trump. You kept on saying Trump this and Trump that. And this week, I like your format and that you're digging into people. You know, to the whole. It's amazing what you went through this week.
Appreciate the comment, Danny. And I'll simply say, yeah, we describe all of these kinds of things. I will tell you that it is relevant. It is significant to understanding what's going on in America. To hear out loud, the reason why I go through these indictments in great detail, it's more than just understanding the specific charges, conspiracy to violate civil rights, those kinds of things. But describing in particular the specific allegations set forth in those indictments, that's important to understanding. And so with respect to both the prior comments and the prior commentary about those indictments and the things we're talking about this morning, go into detail on our radio show so you've got a better sense of what animates the headlines. So appreciate the comment very much, Danny. You have another question or comment to make?
Yes, I was just going to say that I now got a better feeling about you. You are trying to educate the public about stopping this sort of thing. And I'm a very appreciative of that because that's where I was coming from with my comment.
Very good. I appreciate that.
I've got a little bit of lean this week about because I got this task force that you mentioned to talk about. I'm wondering, Jim, if you can in some future time, because you're so intelligent, address the possibility of having a presidential committee that'll screen candidates so you don't get people like Trump even going for office because, you know, he's just seedy. He's beyond that. He's smutty. I hate to say that about a president. That's how I feel about it. I don't think I should have to. And my point is, I think that they ought to establish some sort of committee, much like this task force, maybe to screen out people that are going for presidential offices, so that this sort of thing doesn't happen again.
Right.
I'm tired of it.
Right, your sentiment is shared by me and many, many other people, I think, in the United States of America. The quality of our candidates, right? Certainly the presidency of the United States of America. So appreciate that tremendously. Here's the narrow answer to your question. And again, it's your comment, obviously born of a commitment to our nation and to ensure that people who are serving in all of these positions, whether it's in a federal system, state system, local system, are people of integrity. And so when we come back, I'm going to chat more about that in particular. But for now, let me simply comment about this, and that is that the U.S. Department of Justice obviously has a role to play in addressing both civilly and criminally those people who engage in conduct that's contrary to our laws. There is a larger role for the populace to engage in. You in particular, Danny, me, everybody out there. And when I come back, I'm going to take you up on your good invitation this morning about the reviewing candidacies, and we'll talk about what the Constitution says about that. And the role of important people like you, Danny, and others in making certain the people who are running for office and occupying them as incumbents are indeed advancing our best interests. Stay with us for that further commentary right after this break.
We're in the Civic Media Truth Booth at the Brown County Fair. We asked, and here's what you are telling us about living in the Green Bay area, attending the fair, and more.
Novalee Phelps. I work at the fair at Sheridan Amusements. I work with the kiddie rides. I set up, tear down, wash them, and run them, make little kids happy. I run the raceway. I set it up, tear it down, I help with other kiddie rides. I love putting a smile on kids' faces.
Thanks for sharing your story. Listen for more on the Talk of Green Bay, WGBW 97.9 FM, 1590 AM, and Oshkosh Air Support, WISS 1100 AM, 98.3 FM, and the Civic Media app. And our website, civicmedia.us, and search for Truth Booth. And watch for the Civic Media Truth Booth coming to your town soon. When you think about early labor unions, do you think of Wisconsin? You should. The state's first labor union formed in Milwaukee in 1847 when the bricklayers organized, then the Carpenters Union in 1848. The National Labor Union didn't even form until 1866. A State Historical Society report shows Wisconsin's union members also pushed for workers' compensation and unemployment insurance legislation, becoming a model for other states. For Civic Media, I'm Terry Barr.
You know him as the nose tackle for the green and gold.
1993 to 1999. And again, 2001 to 2003.
125 games, 292 tackles, 7 sacks, and a Super Bowl ring. But there's more to life than stats. And there's more to life than football.
You're about to find out.
Under the Helmet with the Gravedigger. Featuring Packers legend Gilbert Brown.
Monday mornings at 8 on WISS and WGBW and on the Civic Media app.
Looking for more local programming? Check out our website, civicmedia.us, to see our entire lineup.
And we are back this morning on Morning Cannolis, right before the break, talking with caller Danny, who's calling in not only to comment upon the general state of democracy, but also to ask this very important question about the role and responsibility of a possible committee or some sort of review process for examining the legitimacy of the qualifications of people running for office. So let's go back to that and think about what the Constitution says and what civics requires of us as representatives of our communities, both in the elective process, but also in the way of ensuring that our republic is strong. So the Constitution itself, what does the Constitution say about the presidency? James Madison wrote into our Constitution only 3 requirements, and those are, number one, that you be a naturalized citizen. I'm sorry, you be a naturally born citizen here in the United States of America, that you're born in this country as a part of your prerequisites to serving as the president of the United States of America. Second, that you have been in this country for a minimum of 14 years. That also a part of the requirements here. And so those kinds of things set forth in the Constitution of the United States of America, those requirements are the only ones that are imposed by our Constitution. Again, the notion that you were born here, you've lived here, and that you've been a part of our democracy, obviously, in such a way that you can continue to serve in a capacity of responsibility. Beyond that, the question of qualities and importance of the characteristics that you bring, those are the kinds of things that plainly our political process is all about, right? And so Danny's a very important question about, is there a committee, for example, that could review what it is that brings people to the candidacies and basically determine whether or not they're qualified to do the jobs that they're running for. Those are the kinds of things that our political process hopefully will address during the course of debates. We've got, obviously, a recent debate here in Milwaukee, much more of that coming up in the coming year. We've got conventions where people in the political system can likewise identify who it is they want to be their candidates for the presidency and other ways of getting people into the elective process. I would offer, Danny, that the best way of doing that is for people to be informed and to ensure that as a part of the process of Americans participating in our system, that you question our candidates, that you engage with them, you write them letters, do other things to encourage them to tell you about their qualifications. There's nothing in the Constitution that requires that, but our political process plainly envisions, again, in addition to the basic qualifications to become one of these elective positions, become one of our public servants, that you have those kinds of qualities and characteristics that should, in fact, be a part of our system here. So appreciate very much the comment and the notion that we do need to be focused on the kinds of people who are serving in our roles as elected officials, not just the president of the United States of America. I should add as well, the other qualification beyond just years of residence and being born here in the United States of America, you have to be 35 years old, 35 years old to serve as president. Again, that in the Constitution of the United States of America. So all of those things, important things to consider as we think about the candidates who are running this year and future years for elective office in the United States of America. Also have Dana on the line. Dana, calling in from La Crosse. Appreciate your comment or your question.
Good morning, Jim. Happy Saturday to you.
Happy Saturday to you also, Dana.
Thank you. Say, I know you're concentrating more on the Proud Boy and Oath Keeper trials today, but I have a question that's been kind of bugging me. I'm hoping you might be able to answer this week. So there's been a lot of talk lately of the Georgia defendants wanting to move their case to federal court. And what I've been hearing is, okay, sure, it'll still be Georgia law. Fannie Willis would still prosecute it, yada, yada. But my question is on that. Okay, let's say they are convicted. These guys get moved to federal court, and they are convicted under Georgia law, I suppose. Would the penalty be the same? In other words, is it still an unpardonable conviction, or would it switch because it's now a federal court, and so any Republican president could come in and pardon them? Right. That's my question, Jim. I'll take your answer off the air. You have a great weekend.
Great. Dana, thank you so much for calling in. You also have a good Labor Day weekend, you and all of our listeners. And again, great question, not only because it brings, again, civics back into the fore, but also leads into the very next thing, Dana, that I had on my agenda, which is talking about this effort to try to bring at least a portion of the criminal prosecution, the state prosecution in Georgia into federal court, involving specifically Mark Meadows, his testimony before a federal district court judge just this past week. You've got all the civics right, Dana. You've got it all just right. This is not a situation where suddenly there's a brand new indictment, if indeed, in the rare and unlikely, highly unlikely circumstance that the federal district court judge decides that this state court prosecution should proceed in federal court. I will go out on the line here and predict that that will not be happening. But in the event that that should happen, again, the case is transferred there. Again, it's charged under state law and prosecuted by Fannie Willis in federal court, as peculiar as that is. But again, it's a federal proceeding, and so it's a federal judge. The federal rules of evidence would apply, those kinds of things, the trappings of a federal jury would apply, a federal imposition of sentence as well. And so all the trappings of the federal system would apply, be imposed basically like an umbrella upon all of these state procedures. And because it is a federal prosecution, and ultimately could be a federal conviction as well, again, assuming that the jury returns a verdict beyond a reasonable doubt unanimously, yes, indeed, it would be subject to the possibility of a pardon, which is the other reason why these folks are looking to bring this into federal court. Many other reasons for doing that, perhaps including a very slightly more favorable jury pool out there. But all those kinds of things, again, bring with them the federal umbrella on all of this. When we come back, we're going to talk more about specifically what happened in a federal district court judge proceedings in Georgia just this past week involving the very issue that Dana raised when we come back right here on Morning Cannolis.
From I-43 to I-41.
This is the Talk of Green Bay.
1590 AM and 97.9 FM WGBW.
ABC News, I'm Mark Remillard. Powerful rains coming down on the Burning Man Festival in northern Nevada, prompting many to leave or shelter in place. Authorities have now closed the gate to get into Burning Man for the remainder of the event. Las Vegas also seeing flooding. Two people hospitalized after a barrage of Russian drone strikes on the Ukrainian port city near Odessa. President Biden pledging federal support for residents of Florida impacted by Hurricane Idalia. Biden surveyed the damage during a tour of the hard-hit city of Live Oak on Saturday. Florida resident Amy Firestein says many people lost their homes.
It's a great community. Everybody helps each other and wants to help each other, and we want to rebuild. We want Cedar Key back.
Thousands of customers remain without power. A looming strike for the nation's auto workers. Some 150,000 members of the United Auto Workers Union prepared to go on strike. The current contract with GM, Ford, and the parent company of Chrysler expires September 14th. Workers calling for better pay and fewer working hours. This is ABC News.
We're in the Civic Media Truth Booth at the Brown County Fair. We asked, and here's what you are telling us about living in the Green Bay area, attending the fair, and more.
Novalee Phelps. I work at the fair at Sheridan Amusements. I work with the kiddie rides. I set up, tear down, wash them, and run them, and make little kids happy. I run the raceway. I set it up, tear it down. I help with other kiddie rides. I love putting a smile on kids' faces.
Thanks for sharing your story. Listen for more on the Talk of Green Bay, WGBW 97.9 FM, 1590 AM, and Oshkosh Air Support, WISS 1100 AM, 98.3 FM, and the Civic Media app. And our website, civicmedia.us, and search for Truth Booth. And watch for the Civic Media Truth Booth coming to your town soon.
Hi, we're the Goo Goo Dolls. We're fortunate that our daughters have what they need to grow and learn. But that isn't the case for nearly 13 million kids in the U.S. that struggle with hunger.
Childhood hunger is a heartbreaking reality that Feeding America is working to change. Each year, the Feeding America network of food banks rescues billions of pounds of good food that would have gone to waste and provides it to families and children in need.
You can help kids in need in your community by visiting feedingamerica.org.
Brought to you by Feeding America and the Ad Council.
My name is Teresa Barber. I was in the United States Navy, and I served overseas in the Middle East and Africa. Early on in my career, I had a commander that taught our suicide prevention training, and the very next day, he took his own life. 90% of suicide attempts involving a gun are fatal. My way of continuing my service is to help protect my community by being a responsible gun owner and by storing firearms safely. Store all your guns securely. Help stop suicide.
Brought to you by End Family Fire and the Ad Council.
Why are interscholastic sports called the last classroom of the day? Because they teach students important life lessons like teamwork, accountability, and perseverance. School sports are so much more than a game. They're about developing the whole person. That's why they're an essential part of every student's education.
Encourage your student to participate in the last classroom of the day. Interscholastic sports in Wisconsin. This message presented by the WIAA and the Wisconsin Athletic Directors Association.
Do you ever get tired of one-sided conversations? Have you changed the station due to mean-spirited rhetoric? Wouldn't it be refreshing to listen and engage in civilized dialogue about politics and how issues affect our families differently? Welcome to the Rational Revolution. I'm Chris Elfheim.
And I'm Emily Sefos. Together, we'll look at today's issues through a politically purple lens. So join us on Thursday evenings from 7 to 8 on WGBW, WISS, and the Civic Media app.
And we are back. We are talking in these final segments of our broadcast this morning about things happening in Georgia. And right before the break, talking with Dana, his question about the possibility and the consequences of the movement of the state criminal prosecution by Fannie Willis and Fulton County to federal district court, and the what would happen if that were to be the case. And again, offering my view based upon my past experience as a prosecutor, both criminal and civil alike, that it's highly unlikely that will happen because of the standard imposed upon the judge deciding this particular case. Again, pending this past week, some testimony, a motion by Mark Meadows, the former chief of staff for former President Trump, seeking to have his portion of the case, that is his prosecution, removed from the state court into federal court. Again, for a variety of reasons, doesn't remove the criminal aspect of it, but turns it into a federal case for all the consequences that come from that. And Mark Meadows, invoking the standard for doing that, and yes, indeed, there is a statute out there that basically says that if a federal officer, a federal official, is charged in state court criminal prosecution, most often a civil type of litigation, a prosecution, usually for some kind of a constitutional violation, civil rights violation. There is a mechanism under the federal statutes for removal, for moving that case from the state court to federal court, again, premised upon the notion that the activity that is complained of in the state case, that state prosecution brought in a state tribunal, is properly in the federal court. Why? Because the conduct itself partakes of a federal event. Things that the federal officer did in her or his actual execution of their duties and responsibilities in the federal office that they're encumbering. And that's the key, whether or not these things, the activities, the events that are complained of that form the basis for the civil litigation, the criminal litigation, if those conduct, that conduct, those pieces of events that happened, if all those kinds of things were done in the course and duties of responsibilities of that particular person's federal employment, Then there is a circumstance for removing the case. We saw this somewhat unsuccessfully in the end in the E. Jean Carroll matter involving the reporter in New York who sought and was successful in getting a defamation judgment against the former president. He was attempting through the Department of Justice to have that case removed to federal court, having him substituted out, having the Department of Justice come in and defend him. The Department of Justice recently saying, no. When you made those statements, those defamatory statements about E. Jean Carroll, even though you were serving as the president, those were not things that you did in the course of your duties and responsibilities as our chief executive. And so the department, again, fairly recently saying, no, we're not going to be involved in that particular case. So Mark Meadows, again, adopting that appropriate standard, brings into federal court a motion to have the state court proceeding moved into federal court. And what does he say upon questioning this past week by his own lawyers and also by prosecutors? He states emphatically that he believed that his actions that were detailed in the state indictment fell within the scope of his duties as the chief of staff of the president. He appeared somewhat unsure of himself, according to the transcripts of this proceeding, sometimes saying that he couldn't recall details of events in late 2020 and early 2021. Along the way, he said this. He said, my wife will tell you sometimes that I forget to take out the trash. And he is talking about, again, his own conduct during the course of the events alleged in the state court indictment in Georgia. He's testifying in front of a judge named Stephen Jones, U.S. District Court for the Northern District of Georgia. After another point during this day-long hearing of just this past week, Mark Meadows asked the judge if he was complying with the judge's instructions, and Mark Meadows says, I'm in enough trouble as it is, and indeed, Mark Meadows is. He has been charged again in this state court indictment for violations of state law, including the Racketeer Influenced and Corrupt Organizations Act. So in this effort to shift the case from state court to federal court, Meadows testifies, among other things, about this. He says that Donald Trump, when he was president, directed him to set up that now famous telephone call. Remember that telephone call on January 2nd, right after the first of the year, 2021, between Trump and Brad Raffensperger. Raffensperger, you may recall, the Georgia Secretary of State at the time. And during that call, which was the focus of the case, probably prompted Fannie Willis to open this investigation to begin with. We've all heard the tape. We've all heard the audio of that. Donald Trump pressed Raffensperger, said he wanted to find nearly 11,780 votes that were just enough to defeat Joe Biden in Georgia and claim the electoral votes in Georgia. That was what prompted all of this. And Meadows, again, testifying this past week that Donald Trump told him to do that. He said that Trump wanted to make the call because he believed that fraud had occurred, and he wanted to resolve questions about the ballot signature certification process. Meadows going on to say this past week, we all want accurate elections, all right? Raffensperger, interestingly, also testifying, again, about this issue of whether or not when Meadows was there in Georgia, also going to a particular county, Cobb County, Georgia, a ballot audit process was taking place. That after a meeting with Bill Barr, who was then the attorney general at the time. During that meeting, Barr had dismissed election fraud claims as unsupported. But according to his own testimony again this past week, Meadows replied that in his mind, there were still some allegations, some concerns about fraud worthy of investigation, justifying his going to Cobb County, Georgia, trying to figure out what's going on down there. Well, in connection with all of this, as I was about to say, Raffensperger himself the Secretary of State, also testifies. And he said that he recounted how he had ignored some earlier phone calls from Mark Meadows. He said he didn't think it was appropriate. Indeed, Raffensperger was right about that. He thought it was inappropriate for him, that is Raffensperger, to talk to Meadows while Donald Trump was contesting the state's elections results, the very thing that Raffensperger is responsible for. Raffensperger testifies he initially tried to avoid that January 2nd call with Trump, ultimately giving in and under questioning by the prosecutors, described the call as a campaign call. Why is that important? That's important because it goes to this issue once again of whether or not what Mark Meadows was doing at the time, not only making this call, setting it up, but then also going to Georgia, Cobb County, trying to have an influence on the results of that election. All of that related to this issue of whether or not the actions that are under scrutiny here were carried out by Mark Meadows, presumably others, as a part of their official business as your employee of the federal government, as the chief of staff of the White House. And again, not difficult to make this call. The judge is obviously doing a very good job here of establishing a clear record, almost certainly is going to come back and say that this case has got to remain in state court. I will be very surprised if he says just the opposite. All of this indicating, based upon the statements made by Raffensperger, statements, the own testimony about his own conduct, the reasons he was there, do not indicate that going there for a campaign purposes is a part of your duties and responsibilities as a federal official, the chief of staff of the White House, recognizing, I suspect, as the judge does, as he reviews all of this, Judge Jones, U.S. District Court judge again in northern Georgia, recognizing that there's some arguably blurring of lines, if you will. It may not be a bright line between politics and government. But in this particular case where you need to make that phone call based upon the president's encouragement to do it, that plainly a campaign matter, as Raffensperger was indicating, very reluctant to talk at all, feels uncomfortable about it. Why? Because we're intermixing this notion of official duties and responsibilities with campaign and political things. That's the reason why these efforts will almost certainly not be successful. But we'll wait to hear. We'll wait to hear from Judge Jones soon about whether or not the case is transferred. Highly likely it will remain in the state court judge, before the state court judge in Fulton County Superior Court. His name is Scott McAfee. And, of course, he will be presiding over this case as it goes forward. We know in that connection other things related to that case. We also have a couple of the defendants, in particular Ken Cheesbro, Sidney Powell, maybe John Eastman as well, who are seeking a speedy trial. The judge has set an October date, yes, next month, for the trial to begin under state law. That could also proceed. And, of course, we'll anticipate what happens to all 19 defendants, including the former president himself, as that case goes forward. Lots of things to consider, lots of civics this morning in connection with how all of this works. And speaking of trial dates, let's talk more about trial dates having to do with other cases out there in the public domain. On Monday, even before the proceedings in the federal district court judge, before the judge in Georgia, on Monday, Judge Tanya Chutkan has a hearing, and she is now the judge presiding again in Washington, D.C., over the federal indictment against Donald Trump, charging him in 4 counts with allegations of violations of federal law. And so she is presiding over that case, and she sets a trial date of March 4th of 2024 for that trial. Again, a singular indictment against a singular defendant, Donald Trump, proceeding on March 4th, according to Judge Tanya Chutkan. There is a lot to do between now and March 4th. It is entirely possible that under the Speedy Trial Act, there could be some further extensions of that. Defendants under the federal rules appropriately have the right not only to receive all of the discovery, all the information, all the bases upon which the prosecution is premised, and indeed Jack Smith, the special counsel, already providing that to the attorneys for defendant Donald Trump in that federal prosecution there. They're complaining, plainly, about the large volume of that. That's the reason why they sought a trial date of 2026, long, long after the next election, years down the road. Judge Chutkan plainly dismissing that notion, but also not engaging
engaging in and following up on the specific recommendation of January 2nd, which was the recommendation from Jack Smith himself to start the trial at that time. A lot of things have got to happen in these coming months of September, October, November, December, January, February, and again into early March. Pre-trial motions related to the discovery that's being provided. Certainly review of that discovery by defense counsel. Pre-trial motions involving motions to dismiss the indictment. Those are probably coming. Motions to suppress evidence along the way. Other things attacking appropriately. That's what defense counsel are obliged to do, providing a vigorous representation of every defendant in our system. All of that going to happen in the next several weeks and months in front of Judge Chutkan. She has already indicated along the way that she is going to handle this case expeditiously, but she's also going to handle it in a way that ensures that this defendant is no different than any other. Along the way, what does this all mean for scheduling? Plainly, this March 4th date, if it sticks, if indeed there are no further delays in this, we know that there are some other issues out there related to other trials. We're talking about that Fulton County prosecution that's right now still in state court. We talked about the Mark Meadows attempt to bring it into federal court. That case in state court, Fulton County, is also on the docket, if you will, for March 4th to begin on that date. So we've got a conflict there. We know as well that that case in Manhattan, the state prosecution there, it's a criminal case. There he's been accused of more than 30 felonies connected to those hush money payments to that porn actress in the run-up to the 2016 election. That case, again, that state criminal case in Manhattan, that's scheduled to be tried on March 25th of next year. So you've got three of them right now, all in the month of March of next year. And then, of course, we've also got the case involving the classified and other presidential documents case, the Mar-a-Lago case, pending in South Florida. That's another federal criminal prosecution also being handled by Jack Smith's office. Right now, that case, again, being presided over by Eileen Cannon, another federal judge in South Florida, she has scheduled that trial to begin in late May of 2024. All of that coming up very, very soon. Significant that these cases, specifically those in March, happen almost right in the middle of this, the big campaign coming up, already underway, Super Tuesday. Happens right about that same time, the day before Super Tuesday, March 4th, is when that trial is scheduled to begin. Judge Chutkan has indicated, saying that she understands that Donald Trump has other trials scheduled next year. And she also said at the same time, running for the country's highest office is not going to let that specific event, that decision, intersect and drive the scheduling of trial dates in her court. When we come back, we'll tell you more about what Judge Chutkan said and more commentary about the interplay of all of these cases now pending in March and into early 2024.
We're in the Civic Media Truth Booth at the Brown County Fair. We asked, and here's what you are telling us about living in the Green Bay area, attending the fair, and more.
Novalee Phelps. I work at the fair Sheridan Amusements. I work with the kiddie rides. I set up, tear down, wash them, and run them, make little kids happy. I run the raceway. I set it up, tear it down. I help with other kiddie rides. I love to put a smile on kids' faces.
Thanks for sharing your story. Listen for more on the Talk of Green Bay, WGBW 97.9 FM, 1590 AM, and Oshkosh Air Support, WISS 1100 AM, 98.3 FM, and the Civic Media app. And our website, civicmedia.us, and search for Truth Booth. And watch for the Civic Media Truth Booth coming to your town soon.
If you love them enough to listen to them practice the same song on tuba.
Please be done.
Over and over and over and over and over. then surely you'll check NHTSA.gov/the right seat to make sure they're correctly buckled in the back seat.
Sounds good, honey.
Check today at NHTSA.gov/the right seat. Brought to you by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration and the Ag Council.
Wisconsin traditions have been built for years around the Badgers, game day, and the mascot. But lead miners are the original Badgers in the state, not the animal or the mascot. It was the 1820s, and the miners often didn't have shelter in the winters, so they lived like Badgers by digging tunnels into the hillsides to stay warm and sleep where they worked. It led to the reason why today you really can't think of Wisconsin without thinking Badgers. For Civic Media, I'm Terry Barr.
Civic Media radio stations, providing your news, conversations, and fun you won't find anywhere else.
And we are back here for our final segment of this broadcast of Morning Cannolis on a Labor Day weekend, thanking all of our callers, all of you, for listening in on our discussion this morning. Right before the break, talking about this major decision made by Judge Tanya Chutkan, a federal district court judge in the District of Columbia, deciding that the federal indictment, the 4-count indictment against only defendant Donald Trump pending in the federal district court there, would go to trial on March 4th. Along the way, noting this, she said, Mr. Trump, like any defendant, will have to make the trial date work regardless of his schedule, plainly referencing not only his campaign, but arguably some of the other cases he's also got pending, and said, that is Judge Chutkan saying, there is a societal interest to a speedy trial. Indeed, there is, because once again, Donald Trump now indicted by four grand juries in four places, Washington, New York, Atlanta, and Florida, and prosecutors now plainly jockeying for some positions when it comes to all of this. Interestingly, Judge Chutkan noted that she had, in fact, spoken to the judge in the Manhattan case. That is the case being prosecuted by Alvin Bragg. That's the hush money case to the porn star case. It's, again, pending the state criminal prosecution there. His name is Juan Merchan. But it remained unclear about how those judges had resolved this, if at all. But she said she's in consultation with them. Again, nothing wrong with them talking with each other. They should not have an influence directly upon the decisions that they all make. But plainly, all of this is going to make 2024 not only an interesting year for purposes of the campaign, but also for purposes of these various criminal trials, obviously proceeding to trial along the way. The prosecutors indicating a bit about what their case is going to be involved in, probably weeks of jury selection, lots and lots of prosecution, presentation of evidence during the course of the trial, undeniably taking weeks, if not months, to try. During the course of the trial, the attorneys for the defendant, Donald Trump, also said that they're going to be seeking some remedies as well. Even before that, Donald Trump, believe it or not, in a social media post, said he's going to appeal the decision by Judge Chutkan to schedule this as she has. Very unclear on what the basis for that would be, a scheduling decisions of this sort, not generally subject to challenges to higher courts before a conviction is returned, but he said he's going to do that. But his attorneys, perhaps a little bit more appropriately, indicating that they've got a number of motions to file, probably a motion maybe as soon as next week, arguing that Donald Trump is immune to the charges, given that the indictment covers a period when he was serving as the nation's commander-in-chief. Again, this question of whether or not, because of your official duties and responsibilities, you basically should get some immunity for the criminal acts in which you allegedly engaged in. So again, unlikely that will proceed effectively or successfully, but that's in the offing. Also, attorney for Donald Trump said he's considering attacking the charge of the so-called selective prosecution motion. He said he would argue that Donald Trump's election interference indictment, again brought by the special counsel under the Biden administration, has been filed at least in part as retaliation for the federal investigation of Hunter Biden following all this, which began in earnest during the Trump administration. So alleging a selective prosecution challenged to this prosecution. I told Judge Chutkan as well that on behalf of his client, defense counsel planning to challenge each of the three conspiracy counts in the indictment, probably substantively, those accounts again charging Donald Trump with plotting to defraud the United States, to disrupt the certification of the election process during the course of the January 6th proceedings, and significantly, once again, to deprive people of the right to have their voice
and their vote counted. The defense counsel indicated, in our view, this is a political prosecution, and the motions are going to proceed from that. All very appropriate for defense counsel as a part of our system. Key players in all of this always indicate that the system works when there is advocacy, when this adversarial system, as we will see next year in all of these cases, involves not only the presentation of information through witnesses and documents and evidence in court by the prosecution, but also challenges to that by the defense counsel, by a defendant who has a right not only to a jury of her or his peers, but also to confront witnesses and those who would accuse him or her of doing those kinds of things that are charged in the indictment. That's a part of the process. We always hasten to add that defendants, including Donald Trump, including the 19 charged in the indictment in Fulton County, Georgia, including the defendants charged in the Mar-a-Lago case, all of them are presumed innocent until proven guilty in a court of law, which, again, we will probably see in some ways next year, if not beyond. And then also requiring the jury, a jury selected among the common citizens of our nation, who are not necessarily lawyers, not necessarily anyone who's skilled in the law. That's a good thing to bring in, as James Madison anticipated, people who are peers, who can look at the evidence impartially, without partisan views or perspectives, deciding the case based upon what is presented in the four corners of the trial room itself. All of those people required then to deliberate thoughtfully, look at all of the evidence, and make a determination about whether or not the government has proven its case beyond a reasonable doubt. That's the standard. It's a very high standard, appropriately imposed in all of these cases. And then making that decision unanimously. That's the basis upon which the jury in all of these cases, criminal cases, would return a verdict of guilt, if at all. All that process important to our system to ensure legitimacy to the process, not only during the course of the trial, the sentencings that we talked about earlier in the course of our presentation this morning, and also even any appellate proceedings that may happen down the road. In our last few moments here, some additional commentary about something else happening next week. You may recall as well a fellow named Peter Navarro. He was also a former Trump official. He was an economics advisor, appeared a lot on some of these the commentary on the television as well, on cable news stations, commenting politically. Peter Navarro, a part of the Trump administration, its last years, providing economic advice and counsel to the president. You may recall that he was subpoenaed by the House committee investigating January 6th. He was among a number of people referred by the House committee to the Department of Justice for contempt of Congress. And you may recall that Steve Bannon was among them, ultimately convicted in a federal court for violating the terms and conditions, for violating the requirements that he show up to testify in front of that committee. Peter Navarro, also charged by the U.S. Department of Justice with similar offense conduct for failing to appear in front of that House committee investigating January 6th. Peter Navarro also raising the issue just this past week that he believed, based upon things that the president had told him, based upon things the president had directed him to do, that he needed to raise the issue of presidential or executive immunity to the House committee. The judge presiding over that case going to trial on Tuesday, right after Labor Day, Peter Navarro, this coming week, going to trial, rejecting that notion and scheduling the case to begin on Tuesday morning. All of those things happening in justice in America, the rule of law administered America, as we go forward in the weeks ahead. In the weeks ahead, we'll get back to the United States Supreme Court. Big news coming out just this past week. And we're going to talk more about the indictments, not only in the federal courts, but also in the state courts of our United States of America. Join us for those future conversations. Have a good and safe Labor Day, everybody. And join us again for future broadcasts of Morning Cannolis here on the radio stations of Civic Media. Take care, everybody.
We're in the Civic Media Truth Booth at the Brown County Fair. We asked, and here's what you are telling us about living in the Green Bay area, attending the fair, and more.
Novalee Phelps. I work at the fair at Sheridan Amusements. I work with the kiddie rides. I set up, tear down, wash them, and run them.
make little kids happy. I run the raceway. I set it up, tear it down. I help with other kiddie rides. I love to put a smile on kids' faces.
Thanks for sharing your story. Listen for more on the Talk of Green Bay, WGBW 97.9 FM, 1590 AM, and Oshkosh Air Support, WISS 1100 AM, 98.3 FM, and the Civic Media app. And our website, civicmedia.us, and search for Truth Booth. And watch for the Civic Media Truth Booth coming to your town soon.
You're listening to the Talk of Green Bay. WGBW 1590 AM Denmark. W250 CV Green Bay. And always streaming on the Civic ABC Media News app.